are asked, and this is a very important part of our discussion, the Shia are asked to move toward the city of Mecca after the uprising of Sufyani. I will talk about these narrations more in details in one of the future sessions. So somehow, although some Shia are killed by Sufyani, but the Imam of the Ahl Bayt, they ask the Shia that if you hear about the uprising of Sufyani, the only thing that you need to do is that
to
hide and then to go to the city of Mecca. And then at the same time, you will see, Imam Mahdi alayhi salam will reappear. For example, in one narration we read, كَفَى بِسْتُفْيَانِ نِغْمَةً لَكُمْ مِنْ عَدُوبِكُمْ. Sufyani is enough for you as an enemy, which is another narration talking about how cruel Sufyani
and dangerous
is.
Exactly.
Then the Imam says, مَنْ أَرَادَ مِنْهُمْ أَنْ يَخْرُجْ يَخْرُجْ إِلَى الْمَدِينَةِ أَوْ إِلَى مَكَّةِ أَوْ إِلَى بَعْدِ الْبُلْدَانِ. Imam says that those people who want to flee from Sufyani, they need to go to some cities. Imam mentioned some cities. And finally, Imam says that even Medina is not a good option because Sufyani is trying to attack Medina as well. ولكن عليكم بمكة. You need to go to the city of Mecca. فإنها مجمعكم. This is a place that will bring all of you together, referring to the fact that Imam Mahdi alayhi salam will reappear from the same city and from the same place. So if you go to the city of Mecca, you're immune from Sufyani.
You're going to be on a safe side.
Exactly.
We'll discuss more about this after a short break. Dear listeners, stay tuned with us.
I can feel your eyes like the sun shining behind the clouds. I need a morning to shatter this long night forever. I need a hero to stop this thousand-year-old
Welcome back. You're listening to The Last Savior. I am Zainab and Dr. Karimi, and we're discussing about Sufyani, who is one of the certain signs of reappearance. Well, the world has already witnessed a lot of Shia genocide, and now this Sufyani is also going to carry out that again. So may Allah hasten the reappearance of Imam. Dr. Karimi is helping us that, with the suggestions of Imams, like when this kind of situation happens, where to go, where to be safe. Yes, Dr. Karimi.
Yeah, there are some other narrations according to which the Imams of the Ahlul Bayt tell the Shia that if you hear about the uprising of Sufyani, just come toward us, the Ahlul Bayt. And of course, at that time, the member of the Ahlul Bayt who is alive is no one but Imam Mahdi alayhi salam.
Yes.
So it seems that the Imams of the Ahlul Bayt do not invite the Shia to go and fight Sufyani. Of course, Sufyani will attack some countries, some cities whose inhabitants are the Shia. And of course, they need to defend themselves. But if it is possible, the Imams of the Ahlul Bayt have asked the Shia to even hide and then not to, go to fight with Sufyani and just go toward the Ahlul Bayt. The previous narrations explicitly mentioned Mecca. In another narration, Imam al-Sadiq alayhi salam, in an authentic narration addressing one of his companions, whose name is Sudair, says that, Ya Sudair, ilzam baytak wa kun hilsam min ahlasa. A very interesting metaphor. Imam says that, O Sudair, of course, if you are alive at that time, stay at your home. Do not come out of your home and be one of the rogues of your home, meaning that do not leave your home at all. Imagine that you are a rug inside the house. وَاسْكُنْ مَا سَكَنَ اللَّيْلُ وَالنَّهَارِ فَإِذَا بَلَّغَكَ أَنَّ سُفْيَانِ قَدْ خَرَجْ. But as soon as you hear that Sufyani has begun his uprising, فرحل إلينا, just come toward us, the Ahlul Bayt عليهم السلام, ولو على رجليك, even if you need to come on foot. This is how important this task is. So فرحل إلينا, come toward us, it means, as I mentioned, toward the Ahlul Bayt عليهم السلام. And of course, at that time, we are talking about Imam Mahdi, may Allah hasten his reappearance. This is in Al-Kafi, page 264, hadith 383. In another interesting narration, which is again mentioned in Al-Kafi by Sheikh Kulaini, page 274, hadith 412, Imam Sadiq alayhi salam says, and in this narration he is addressing another companion of him whose name is Fadl. He says, لا تبرح الأرض يا فادل حتى يخرج السفياني. O Fadl, before the uprising of Sufyani, do not move, meaning that stay at your home, meaning that do not go to fight, Sufyani and his army.
Okay.
فَإِذَا خَرَجَ السُّفْيَانِ فَأَجِيبُ إِلَيْنَا. When you hear about the uprising of Sufyani, answer our call. Imam repeated that three times. فَأَجِيبُ إِلَيْنَا, فَأَجِيبُ إِلَيْنَا, فَأَجِيبُ إِلَيْنَا. Answer our call, meaning that again joining the Ahlul Bayt alayhi wassalam.
Ahlul Bayt are going to be the refuge.
Exactly. And at that time, we are talking about Imam Mahdi alayhi wassalam in the city of Mecca. And in this narration, Imam also refers to the fact that وَهُوَ مِنَ الْمَحْتُومِ, the uprising of Sufyan is one of the certain and definite signs for the reappearance of Imam Mahdi alayhi salam. So all these narrations again refer to the fact that the uprising of Sufyani is very close to the reappearance of Imam Mahdi alayhi salam, and the task and the duty of the Shia is, at least for those people who are able, just to go and move toward the city of Mecca to join the great army of Imam Mahdi, may Allah hasten his reappearance.
Inshallah. Thank you so much, Dr. Karimi. So safest place to seek refuge in that time is going to be to seek refuge in Ahlul Bayt, which is repeated so many times in narrations. And you said it's thrice said that answer our call. And if mentioning about the places, the safest place is going to be Mecca. May Allah hasten the reappearance of our Imam, and may he be the savior, because he is the last savior. Thank you so much, dear listeners, for being with us. You were listening to IRIB English Radio. Until another session, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Midstream.
It has become crystal clear that the sanctions imposed by the USA on Syria are punitive measures that specifically target the Syrian people, children, women, old men, and young adults, with no exception for the sick or hungry children, or those trapped under the rubble of an earthquake, or the millions who now sleep out in the open in harsh weather conditions. The human tragedy that resulted from the catastrophic earthquake in Turkey and Syria is expanding because of the huge loss of life and property. However, it is crucially important at this stage for all countries of the world, specifically the Islamic nation, to collaborate to help the two peoples overcome the effects of the catastrophe and heal the wounds of the tragedy, especially the Syrian people. This is crucial given the lack of capabilities of the Syrian state to carry out operations to rescue the victims, secure those afflicted, and rebuild due to continuous international crimes committed against Syria, incited by the Zionist entity and its leadership in the United States of America. The philosophy of the American arrogance is the framework surrounding the crime committed against Syria. The crime took various forms, beginning and ending with sanctions, passing through siege and looting, continuing with strife and wars, and attempts at disintegration and division. Encompassing all these crimes is the highest interest of the Zionist entity. The entity that airdropped humanitarian aid, especially packed for tragedy-stricken Syria in the form of bombs and missiles, sent only 13 days after the greatest natural disaster that hit Syria in more than 100 years. The special Zionist package of death killed 5 civilians and wounded 20 others after targeting a residential area in the capital, Damascus. Has any other nation in modern history endured so far what Syria has? Despite Syria overcoming most of the challenge of the global war directed by Zionists and Americans against it, especially the danger of dividing the people and the land, in came the illegal Caesar's Act to complement the global Zionist Western war on Syria in an attempt to accomplish what the war failed to achieve by overthrowing the Syrian state. This hindered the Syrian state's capabilities from dealing with the earthquake disaster and at some point crippled the government institutions, impeding them from reaching certain stricken areas devastated by the disaster. All the while, the U.S. has been actively depriving Syria of its oil resources and agricultural lands looted by the Americans, destroying the bulk of its economic assets. This crime, which brought Syria to this disastrous situation through sanctions, siege, war, and looting, is what exacerbated and multiplied the earthquake catastrophe, and even made the U.S. crime committed against it with intent and persistence more dangerous than the natural disaster that hit the war-torn country. Welcome to the Mideast Stream. I'm Marwa Osman. Can overcome the disaster of the earthquake with its own capabilities and the support of its friends, but it will certainly overcome it effectively and quickly, along with all its internal crises, when the crime committed against it under American leadership and Zionist incitement stops. The crime took various forms, beginning and ending with sanctions, passing through siege and looting, continued with strife and wars and attempts to disintegrate Syria and divide it. The crime is governed by the philosophy of American arrogance as a framework, and its compass is the interest of the Zionist entity as a final goal. To discuss this issue with us from Beirut is Dr. Jamal Wakim, author, academic, and managing editor of the Contemporary Arab Affairs Journal. Thank you very much for being with us, Dr. Wakim. Now, the lack of capabilities that was master of the scene inside Syria after the devastating earthquake results from a continuous international crime against Syria instigated by the Zionist entity and the U.S. regime, while just less than 2 weeks later, after the earthquake, we saw the Zionist entity dropping bombs on the heads of the Syrians sleeping in the comfort of their homes, of their houses in Damascus just 3 days ago. Is there a real way out for Syria from this?
Too bad. I believe that Syria will keep suffering from this situation as long as the United States is trying to destabilize the country, trying to support some separatists in northeast Syria, mainly the Qasad Kurds, and in an attempt to redraw the whole geopolitical map of the region, including Lebanon, Syria, and Iraq, based on confessional and ethnic lines. So that's why I believe that the United States didn't care much about the earthquake that happened, but saw it as an opportunity to further weaken Syria, to further try to destroy it, because what has been done by the earthquake was been done by the United States over the past 13 years now, alongside the Zionist entity. So And added evidence is the latest Israeli strike against civilians, peaceful civilians in Damascus. I believe that too bad we don't have a way out so far.
Well, the aim of the United States imposed sanctions on Syria is basically to subjugate the people, the regime and the state and the institutions of the state as well to the will of the U.S. foreign policy. And this has been the game since the beginning of the war in 2011. So far, this has failed. Will this devastating earthquake break the will of the Syrian people this time?
I don't believe so, because the Syrians have been resilient over the past 13 years. They have been supporting the majority of them, of course. They have been supporting their government against the attempts to destabilize it, to destabilize the country and to divide it into various states and sub-states. I believe that they will keep fighting, and they are benefiting from the support of their allies and some Arab brothers, including, for example, the support that came from Iran, Russia, Iraq, Algeria, Lebanon, and other Arab states. Not many Arab states abstentiated from giving support, but I'm talking about many Arab states that did actually send support to Syria. And Syria will benefit from this to further resist the U.S. attempts to weaken it and to bring the country to its knees.
Well, Dr. Joachim, the most important, the impact of U.S. sanctions on Syria was depriving it of its oil resources and of the agricultural lands as well in the northeastern part of the country, which was stolen by the Americans by destroying the bulk of what economy Syria has left and transforming it into a country that was once self-sufficient into a country that is always dependent on others to in basic needs of food, medicine, supplies, oil. So this brings the question of direct resistance against the actual physical U.S. occupation inside Syria, especially in the eastern part of the Euphrates. Is Syria in a state that would allow it to pursue such a resistance against an occupation that's already there?
I believe that the Syrians are preparing themselves for such a development. However, for the time being, I don't believe that it's within the capability of the Syrian government to support an armed resistance against the American occupation in northeast Syria. The Syrian government is trying to appease the Kurdish separatists there in order to draw them into dialogue with the government, and this is a mean for them to contain the situation. That's why they are refraining from supporting armed struggle in northeast Syria. But eventually, if the Americans persist in their occupation of this region, if they persist in supporting the separatists in their aim to divide Syria, I believe that it's out of question for the Syrians not to launch a war of resistance against this occupation.
Well, but lastly, Dr. Joachim, what the Western mainstream media is propagating on its platforms is that the U.S. has, in fact, effectively removed and lifted the sanctions of Syria for it to allow for aid to help. But you know, as much as I know, that this is not the case because the Syrian banking system is still not working. People cannot wire money to Syria to help their families and their friends. So what was that announcement about, and what will it take for the U.S. to actually ease those sanctions?
Well, the U.S. made this declaration, which is a false declaration because it didn't get implemented on ground, but because they were forced to make this declaration because they were faced by a wave of indictment by the majority of the countries in the world and the majority of the people in the world. because the American government saw itself embarrassed, and that's why it made such a vocal declaration void of any essence, actually, because as you mentioned, the banking system in Syria is still under sanctions. The Americans are still pressuring the separatist Kurds in northeast Syria not to allow aid to cross from the regions that they dominate into the government-dominated regions. There are other, sanctions that are still in place. So that's why I believe that what the Americans did was a PR move in order to avoid embarrassment, especially after this wave of indictment by the majority of the peoples around the world.
So in less than a minute, Dr. Joaquin, so do you think that the help that Syria got from the states that actually broke the Caesars Act within hours from the earthquake would be sufficient for it to try and at least reconstruct what the earthquake broke?
Too bad, despite the generous aid coming from friendly and brotherly countries to Syria, like Iran, Iraq, Russia, Lebanon,
Algeria.
Jordan, Algeria, etc. However, this aid is short of helping the government restructure the whole economy, especially that it's still passing through a state of war imposed on it by the United States and the Zionist entity. So this will be short of helping Syria achieve its aim in reconstructing the country. We need more aid, we need more lavish donations and bilateral cooperation between Syria and other countries in order to be able to overcome this situation.
We actually do see that in the near future, because the people in Syria do need our help very much and as soon as possible as well. I want to thank you very much, Dr. Jamal Joaquin, author, academic, and managing editor of the Contemporary Arab Affairs Journal, for joining us to talk about this crucial matter. Now, ladies and gents, please stay tuned, because next we will be talking about a new way that Israel has came up with for ethnic cleansing in Palestine.
This is Midstream, and here is IRIB English Radio. Dear listeners, in this weekly program, Marvo Osman discusses two important issues related to West Asia region with two political analysts. Midstream is with you every Friday on IRIB English Radio.
The Israeli Knesset approved a new racist law to revoke citizenship and residency from Palestinian prisoners who carried out heroic operations against the occupation's army and its settlers who reside in the Palestinian territories of 1948 and occupied Al-Quds. Now, the law provides for the deportation of these prisoners from their hometowns immediately upon the end of their sentence to areas supposedly controlled by the Palestinian Authority. Let's see more details about this following report.
The Israeli Knesset has passed a law making it easier for authorities to revoke citizenship and residency from Palestinians imprisoned who carried out heroic operations against the occupation army and its settlers over what Israel designates as, quote, acts of terror, unquote. The final reading of the bill, which for the first time stipulates the deportation of Palestinians to the occupied territories, was passed last Wednesday afternoon by a vast majority of Knesset, with 94 votes in support and just 10 against. This new racist law provides for the deportation of these prisoners from their hometowns immediately upon the end of their sentence to areas controlled by the Palestinian Authority. It is noticeable in the vote on this law that it came with a broad Israeli consensus among members of the government coalition and the Israeli opposition at the same time, and a dangerous indication of the dimensions of this law on the Palestinians in the occupied territories, as well as the unified Israeli position in targeting the Palestinian man, his identity, and his land. The danger of the timing of the law's adoption is that it came in an Israeli political environment that is witnessing disagreements and an escalation of the state of political tensions, conflicts, and real divisions, which reads that the Israeli occupation, when it comes to the Palestinians, they unite immediately. The targeting of this law goes beyond the issue of targeting the prisoners who carried out operations against the army of the occupation and its settlers. Rather, it is the beginning of a blatant and broad legitimization of a forced displacement and mass expulsion of Palestinians in the occupied Palestinian territories. The implementation of this law paves the way for the withdrawal of nationality and residency to implement displacement and ethnic cleansing projects against the Palestinians, especially against the residents of Wadi Ara, which is a Palestinian village occupied since 1948, and the appropriate circumstances waiting for the passage of this decades-old project. The danger in the law is that it flouts international and humanitarian law, and the start of its application means that it will be applied retroactively against Palestinians who were previously arrested in Israeli prisons and received salaries from the Palestinian Prisoners Affairs Authority as released prisoners as a crime, and their citizenship will be revoked and they will be forcibly displaced from their homes. The racist Israeli law is in stark contrast to international law, which prohibits the expulsion of any citizen from his homeland and country. It also forms the basis for political precautions and the excessive use of the emergency systems that the Israeli occupation entity inherited from the British Mandate, including movement restrictions, administrative detention and expulsion based on ethnicity and Palestinian nationality.
New ways by Israel to ethnically cleanse the Palestinian state and nation. With us to discuss this issue from the occupied Al-Quds is Dr. Mohammad Halassi, academic and researcher in Zionist Israeli affairs. I want to thank you, Dr. Halassi, for being with us now. The seriousness of the timing of the adoption of the Israeli law requiring the withdrawal of citizenship and residency from Palestinian prisoners who carried out these heroic operations, it comes at a political moment in Israel where there is real division inside of the Israeli entity. So they fight over everything, but unanimously vote for expelling more native Palestinians from their lands. But why now, and what might be the repercussions of such a law?
This Israeli behavior is not limited to this decision taken by the Knesset of the occupation. Rather, Israel practiced such an act previously and in an effort by this government to implement its subjugation agenda. This is settler colonialism that did not come to coexist with the Palestinians. On the contrary, it came to replace it. In addition to the machine of oppression and force exercised by the armored vehicles and tanks, it also seeks, through the legislation it enacts, to expel the Palestinians. This law is in the service of the colonial system. When it comes to the Palestinians, the laws set by the occupation's Knesset comes to serve this colonial agenda, which ultimately aims to empty the Palestinian land of its inhabitants and replace them with the Zionist settlers. This comes, as you kindly pointed out, in light of the conditions of division experienced by Israeli society. However, this society, which shows signs of division and disintegration, comes together and unites completely from their far right to their far left when matters relate to the Palestinian rights. The Zionist left, which formed previous governments, has always watched the actions of the right towards the Palestinians and has never said a word. Now, when the Zionist far-right's fire bounces back internally on Israeli society, you see them demonstrating and shouting loudly to stop the far-right's advance and impose their internal agenda on the Israeli society. Yet, when it comes to the Palestinians, you see them unite and agree. When it comes to the Palestinians, they are one voice and one unit. This law comes to confirm the racism of this Israeli society and its unity to exclude the Palestinians. There is no difference in this society between its left, its center, and its far right. This law will inevitably backfire on the Israelis. The Israelis believe that imposing the logic of force and coercion on the Palestinians will bring security to its society. But experiences have shown that the more the Israeli coerce and penetrate with arrogance the Palestinian society, the more the Palestinians adhere to their rights, and the more these actions backfire on the Israelis, who will pay the price for their racism. We saw how the Palestinian society, with the natural reactions of its members, inflicted human losses on the Israeli society, causing it to lose security from a government that claimed that it was coming to impose security to protect the Israeli society.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Muhammad, the goal behind the law goes beyond the issue of targeting only the Palestinian prisoners. We all know how the Zionist entity thinks and the occupation thinks. Rather, it is just the beginning of a blatant and broad legitimization of forced displacement and ethnic cleansing of the Palestinian people in the occupied territories. That is basically the definition of what ethnic cleansing is. But who's to stop Israel from doing this? Let's say they did begin doing this. What can stop Israel from pursuing this?
Before this government, there were no Israeli governments that carried roses and brought peaceful stances towards the Palestinian people. On the contrary, all the governments that preceded this one were right-wing. We have experienced Sharon's government with his policy of breaking the bones of the Palestinians. We have seen many Israeli political leaders who left, their parties ended, their slogans ended, but Palestine remained, and the Palestinian people remained. Who stood and who will continue to stand in the face of these arrogant racist calls? Israel's problem is that it becomes blind in front of the issue of Palestinian national rights. It believes that this people has no history and that it had no national political entity. Israel wants to deal with Palestinians as mere human groups that can only have regular daily life demands, and does not want to recognize the right of this Palestinian people to their freedom and independence. As long as it deals with the Palestinians from a security angle, and as long as it views the Palestinians as a security threat, then the Israeli society will be enlightened in paying the bill for this blindness and disregard for the rights of an entire people. Israel is a manipulator who believes that the balance of power and the logic of force transcends its large military system and transcends the coverage it gets, unfortunately, from some Arab regimes. Israel is under the cover of the United States of America and international institutions, so it believes that the Palestinians can be broken. This is an issue that has always been shattered on the rock of the steadfastness of the Palestinians. This law will fall. The Palestinian prisoners and the Palestinian people will overthrow it with their steadfastness and their continued struggle, just as all previous racist laws have fallen. In this matter, we do not count on international bodies or international institutions. We count on the will of the Palestinian people.
This is exactly what this is what I want to point out, Dr. Muhammad, is that despite the normalization that some of the Arab regimes have conducted with the Zionist entity, at least there must be some sort of a clear stance against such a law, which is basically an open law against ethnic cleansing of the Palestinians. And yet we hear nothing. We didn't even hear a condemnation coming from them. I mean, at least a condemnation. Would you think there would be otherwise?
First of all, these Arab regimes have no free will to begin with. They are led under patronage of the American administration to sign peace agreements with Israel. They lack the political will and they do not rely on the popular will, which is completely contrary to the desires of the political regimes that see Israel as a friend. In terms of the international community, it is a hypocritical community. The European Union is a hypocritical union. The Western colonial international system is also a sponsor of this occupation, and it is the one that provides the Western and Arab regimes with reasons not to condemn Israel. We are accustomed to hypocritical behavior, and we have seen it previously in situations when Israel bombed Palestinian homes and killed our children and the elderly. When Israel implements its colonial destruction machine, we do not hear this system condemning this Israeli behavior and these Israeli actions. While when the armed Zionist settlers who attack the Palestinians are killed by the Palestinians who are defending themselves, we see how the cries of the Arab world rise and the cries of the international world rises. On top of which is the United States to condemn the Palestinian actions, which we consider to be self-defense. Unfortunately, we did not expect from the world other than this behavior of what we are familiar with. This world respects only the strong, and the Palestinians do not need condemnations. The Palestinians need actions from the international community. We need them only to subjugate Israel to abide by the law. Global behavior deals with Israel as a state above the law. allowing it to continue its aggression, racism, and legislation that it enacts, which are in violation of international laws legislated by the institutions of the international community. Yet, we see the world remaining silent in front of legislation that violates human dignity and human rights endorsed by this same international community.
Definitely. Which is why, Dr. Mohammed, we believe in the resistance of the Palestinian people and their right for an armed, a full armed resistance against this occupation and its aggression and its blatant ethnic cleansing against the people of Palestine. I want to thank you very much from Occupied Al-Quds, Dr. Mohammed Halaseh, academic and researcher in Zionist Israeli Affairs, for joining us to talk about this pressing matter. Dear ladies and gents, thank you very much. We will see you again next week with more from the Mideast Stream.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily round the clock for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave, FM, and satellite. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 31 meters, 9,650 kilohertz, every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 49 meters, 6,040 kilohertz, and in southern Africa via shortwave 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz, every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 megahertz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iran Sadorbat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you. In the limelight.
In the U.S., a new policy by the Biden administration limits asylum access at the southern border with Mexico. We take a look at the U.S. media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. Los Angeles Times has covered this story and tells us more. The Biden administration announced a policy on Tuesday, 21st of February, that would limit asylum access for immigrants who cross into the United States without authorization and fail to apply for protections on the way to the southern border with Mexico. The proposal will not take effect immediately and will go through a regulatory process to allow public comment for 30 days. After that time, the policy is said to be in place for 2 years following its effective date. It is the latest Biden administration proposal to deter migrants from entering the United States without authorization and to bring down the number of migrants crossing the southern border with Mexico. The policy is being unveiled as the administration prepares for the expected end in May of Title 42, a Trump-era policy that allows border agents to quickly turn back migrants. We are a nation of immigrants and we are a nation of laws. We are strengthening the availability of legal, orderly pathways for migrants to come to the United States, at the same time proposing new consequences on those who fail to use processes made available to them by the United States and its regional partners, Department of Homeland Security Secretary Alejandro Mayorkas said in a statement. The government had struggled to lower the number of crossings at the border before it decided to expand its use of Title 42 in January to expel Nicaraguans, Haitians, Venezuelans, and Cubans to Mexico. At the same time, the Department of Homeland Security allowed immigrants from those countries who had verified sponsors in the United States to enter the country legally. After the announcement, the numbers of unauthorized border crossings went down in January to their lowest levels in almost 2 years. Since Biden administration officials hinted at the effort in January, advocates have criticized the idea, saying it mirrors Trump's move to block asylum for those who crossed into the United States without authorization and did not seek protections in another country of their journey. That proposal was later blocked in U.S. federal courts. We will sue if this administration goes through with a transit ban, just as we successfully sued over the Trump transit ban, said Lee Gallant, a senior attorney with the American Civil Liberties Union, ACLU. On Tuesday, 21st of February, immigrant advocates were critical of the proposal and condemned the intentions of the Biden administration. We're deeply disappointed to see the Biden administration announce what is effectively a ban on asylum, Sergio Gonzalez, executive director of the Immigration Hub, an advocacy organization, said in a statement. Sergio Gonzalez previously served on the Biden administration's transition team. Asylum decisions are a matter of life and death. Denying people a fair chance to seek safety and freedom under U.S. law flies in the face of America's moral leadership on the protection of refugees and President Biden's campaign promise to rebuild a fair, humane, and orderly immigration system, he said. Lori Ball Cooper, Legal Services Director for the International Refugee Assistance Project, said in a statement that the move was unconscionable. This asylum ban was illegal when the Trump administration proposed it, and it is illegal now. President Biden should restore full access to the asylum system immediately, she said. Chris Magnus, a former Biden administration official who led U.S. Customs and Border Protection before being forced to resign, said the new effort was confusing. I'm trying to understand how we can authentically commit to our asylum laws and values, but then propose policies so inconsistent with those same values, he said. Biden administration officials, however, have said the new policy is not comparable to Trump-era policy because it would not categorically ban asylum and offers a way to gain asylum access at a port of entry. This administration just won't allow mass chaos and disorder at the border because of Congress's failure to act, an administration official said on a call with reporters on Tuesday. To be clear, this was not our first preference or even our second preference. From day one, President Biden has urged Congress to pass the comprehensive immigration reform and border security measures to ensure orderly, safe, and humane processing of migrants at our border. Under the proposal, immigrants who cross the southern border without authorization after traveling through a third country and have not been denied asylum in a country on their way to the United States would be forced to overcome a presumption that they are ineligible for asylum. Immigrants unable to overcome that hurdle would be liable to deportation unless they meet one of several exceptions included in the policy or clear a higher bar for protection in the U.S. asylum officers are expected to handle interviews of immigrants crossing the border. CBS News has also covered this story and tells us more. The Biden administration published a proposal on Tuesday, 21st of February, that would disqualify certain migrants from U.S. asylum and allow the government to deport them more quickly, saying the major policy shift is needed to curb unlawful migration at the southern border with Mexico. The regulations, which will not take effect until after the government responds to comments from the public, would render migrants ineligible for U.S. asylum if they cross the southern border illegally after failing to ask for humanitarian refuge in another country such as Mexico. Those unable to prove that they are not barred from seeking asylum under the rules could be quickly deported without a chance to see an immigration judge. The Department of Justice and Homeland Security, which oversees the judges and officers who review asylum cases, will give the public 30 days to comment on the proposed regulations before implementing them. The government told the Supreme Court earlier this month it plans to finalize the regulations by early May. Once they take effect, the rules would last for 2 years, subject to a review that could lead to their expiration, extension, or modification. If enacted, the rules would be a seismic change to U.S. asylum policy, barring most non-Mexican migrants from crossing the southern border into the United States, in between designated ports of entry from requesting refuge. U.S. law gives those on American soil the right to seek asylum, regardless of whether they entered the country without permission. The proposed regulations also represent a notable immigration policy pivot by President Biden, who campaigned on restoring access to the asylum system and overturning the hardline border policies of his predecessor Donald Trump. In 2019, the Trump administration enacted a similar regulation that also penalized migrants who crossed the United States southern border with Mexico without first asking for asylum in a third country. That rule, known as the asylum transit ban, was ultimately struck down in federal courts of law. Advocates for asylum seekers said the proposed regulations are the Biden administration's version of the transit ban and have vowed to challenge them in federal courts of law. The last thing the Biden administration should be doing is replacing one inhumane Trump-initiated policy with its own version of another inhumane Trump administration policy, said Eleanor Acer, Senior Director for Refuge Protection at Human Rights First, a group that advocates for asylum seekers. The Biden administration has justified the proposed restrictions on asylum eligibility by pointing to record number of migrant apprehensions reported along the U.S.-Mexico border in recent years. U.S. border officials processed migrants over 4 million times in fiscal years 2021 and 2022. Biden officials have rejected accusations that they are reinstating a Trump-era rule, noting their proposal will have humanitarian exemptions, including for unaccompanied children. Those eligible for an exemption are migrants with acute medical conditions, those fleeing imminent and extreme danger, and victims of human trafficking.
Ask the followers of the remembrance if ye know not.
Rabbana, Rabbana, ya Rabbana.
You're listening to the program The Key on IRIB English Radio with Shiraz Hossein Agha, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Rome and a PhD in philosophy.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome to our program, The Key, here at IRIB English Radio. Today on The Key, we would like to offer our congratulations to our esteemed listeners because today is the anniversary of the birthday of the third Imam of the family of the Prophet, Sallallahu Alaihi Wasallam, Imam Hussein Alayhi Salam. Today on The Key, we're going to be looking at a very important question, and that question is, what proof is there that Imam Hussein actually received the imamate and was a recipient of the imamate after his brother Imam Hassan? This question might seem at first glance to be silly and superficial, because a lot of us have taken it for granted, the imamate of each of the imams. To be honest, if we look at this problem in a historical fashion, we will see that in the past, this wasn't such an easy matter for a lot of the followers of the maktab and the school of thought of the Ahlul Bayt. A lot of times, there was a great dispute amongst the followers of the family of the Prophet, of the imams, regarding the succession of an imam, or who was to succeed a preceding imam, right? And because of this, if you look at the annals of history, and also if you take a glance at the texts regarding the subject of the various firaq and sects within Islam, you see that there was a lot of offshoots from tashayyu and Shi'ism regarding this problem, right, regarding this matter. Right? Some when an imam would pass away, and a lot of people, different people would start believing in the imamate of different people, right? So this is an important topic. Fortunately, we have many hadiths which have been narrated regarding the imamate of each of the imams. Regarding Imam Hussein alayhi salam, we have many hadiths regarding the succession of Imam Hussein and his being the imam. Hadith which we would like to recite for you today has been narrated from the Lady Fatima, his mother. The Lady Fatima, Salamullah alayha, narrated the following. The Prophet, sallallahu alayhi wa alayhi wa sallam, came to me after I gave birth to Hussein alayhi salam. So I gave him, meaning Imam Hussein, to the Prophet in a yellow cloth, which he cast aside, and he wrapped him in a white cloth. He then said, Fatima, take him. He is indeed an imam. خُذْ بِهِ يَا فَاطِمَةَ فَإِنَّهُ إِمَامٌ and the son of an imam, ibn imamin, and from his loins, he is the father of nine imams, from his loins will come virtuous imams, the ninth of whom will be Al-Qa'im, the awaited savior of mankind. This is very explicitly states that Imam Hussein alayhi salam, his imamate was indeed transferred to him from his brother Imam Hassan alayhi salam, and then subsequently the imamate was passed from him to his sons and his grandsons. Thank you for joining us here on The Key. We were looking at the proof for the imamate of Imam Hussein alayhi salam. Until next time, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
That was Shiraz Hussein Agha, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Rome and a PhD in philosophy, on the program The Key on IRIB English Radio.
You can also send your questions to English Radio at irib.ir.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. 31 meters, 9,650 kilohertz for the Indian subcontinent, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.